Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. In episode 21, some of the science that can be done on the Moon. Geophysics is one. Pure physics and relativity is another. Flammability in lunar gravity. What are the knowledge gaps that, if filled, would allow transformative research? This first talk was given in February of 2021.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am Ernie Bell. I'm currently finishing up my PhD in geophysics at the University of Maryland. Previously, though, I was an EVA flight controller at JFC. I worked with both Alex and Jackie. For this presentation, so first off, what is geophysical data and why do we need to conduct geophysical investigations on the Moon? Well, geophysical data includes identification of stratigraphic layers of the subsurface, determining various physical, mechanical, and electromagnetic properties, and also looking at heat flow characteristics. Geophysical data can also help to identify and characterize natural resources, such as volatiles, and looking at mechanical or structural type resources. So how does this fit in with the objectives of the Artemis program? By acquiring these types of data sets, which I've just mentioned and others, we can help to understand the planetary processes of volcanism, tectonics, regolith creation, as well as overall planetary formation. We can help to characterize and determine the origin of polar volatiles, understand the impact history of the Earth-Moon system. In addition, this data can be used to investigate and mitigate various exploration risks. So now I just want to provide a few examples of the types of geophysical studies that we perform on Earth. They include things such as magnetometry. I have examples of both active and passive variations of seismic studies. You'll see some 3D laser or LIDAR mapping of geologic features. And then there's also gravimetry, radar sounding that we performed in the field.
Cynthia Evans works in the Johnson Space Center's Astromaterials Research and Exploration Science Division. In February of 2021, she described the GeoLab.
So the current architecture plans for sustained lunar operations include an Artemis base camp around 2030 that'll have a foundational surface habitat that we call the FISH with science outfitting. There'll be mobility for astronauts, both unpressurized and pressurized rovers, and then the capabilities for EVAs. And right now the plans are talking about 30 to 60 day missions for humans with the potential for sustained robotic operations for the rest of the year. So there's lots of opportunity for science team involvement for extended lunar missions. There's going to be crew traverses, sample collection, habitat-based science, robotic traverses, and the potential to collect a whole lot of geological samples, potentially exceeding the return mass. So sample prioritization may be required. So we did tests about 10 years ago, Desert Rats, and part of the tests between 2010 and 2012 included a habitat demonstration unit that was simulated sustained operations. And so it was a habitat that had science outfitting in it. We had a glove box we called GeoLab that was integrated into the habitat, and I'm going to talk about that. A GeoLab, it was fully integrated into the habitat structure that, and it was, we had it integrated, the structure, the power, the network, the avionics, the software, and it was designed to receive samples directly into the glove box from the outside. There were three antechambers that cut through the bulkhead of the habitat that went directly into the glove box for sample delivery. And then it was configurable so that we could test different instruments. I'll talk about this in a little bit more detail. The hardware, it was modeled after the curation glove boxes. It was stainless steel and Lexan. It was designed to be able to withstand positive nitrogen pressure. I mentioned that the sample delivery was through the bulkhead through a series of little airlocks that we called antechambers in the back. We on the left-hand side, we had several different instrument ports where we could swap instruments. We see a handheld XRF. We had network cameras on either side for situational awareness. We had a pan tilt zoom network camera overhead that the back room could control for, again, for monitoring operations. We had a microscope that was a network microscope for doing detailed analysis of the samples. And we had tools inside the glove box itself, touch screens for data entry, custom software for data entry and tracking. We also tested RFID tracking of samples. And the third year, we had a robotic sample manipulator integrated inside the glove box.
One of the most useful things the Apollo astronauts did was set out corner cube reflectors that enabled laser beams of light to be pointed at the moon and the reflection detected back here on Earth. Half a century later, those retro reflectors are still in use. From them, we have learned a lot about the moon's motion and have tested Einstein's theory of relativity. Slava Tyryshev is a research scientist at Pasadena's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. In August of 2021, he gave a talk on the fundamental physics research that can be done on the lunar surface. In his introduction, he spoke of missions that could be conducted between 2021 and 2028.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. So in this presentation, we will talk about relevance of fundamental physics for the research on the moon, and really we'll cover the science objectives and also the technologies that are being developed and will be deployed on the lunar surface and in lunar orbit that will enable not only the science exploration of the moon, testing fundamental physics theories, but also to enable transition to the lunar environment and then next to Mars. Excellent. So this is a little summary of what to expect in the near time frame. So realistically, there is unprecedented number of lunar missions. We have a significant lunar traffic with more than 40 missions planned, including 68 space vehicles, including sort of involving many national space agencies. It's very important to note that there is a very prominent presence of private space industry, including SpaceX, Moon Express, Astrobotics, Blue Origin, Sierra Nevada Corporation, Mustang Space Systems, and many others. There are multiple emerging trends in cislunar activities. We have a significant emphasis on lunar surface exploration, with more than 16 missions going to be to deploying lunar lander, rover, or both. So there is emergence of lunar relay orbiters. At least 4 missions are planning to deploy lunar relay orbiters to serve landed vehicles and serve as navigational beacons. There will be many CubeSat and SmallSat missions. There will be mixed crewed and robotic missions, both in orbit and the lunar surface. So there will be multiple commercial landers to deploy science instruments and technology demonstrations on the moon. There is a major technology advancement and science opportunities are expected. So there is emergence of long duration sensor networks on the moon, on the lunar surface. There is increased interest for lunar far side, with quite a few landers and rovers on the rim of the South Pole and actually on the far side of the moon as well. So there is opportunities for optical in the near side and radio on the far side telescopes for astronomy and cosmology. So this is very interesting developments that are ongoing, and it's really the feel is that is really going to be happening in the very near time frame. And really the emphasis is how do we benefit from this? What fundamental physics role in these activities, and how fundamental physics will benefit from this, and also how this area will contribute to the lunar exploration.
Slava next explained what lunar laser ranging is.
I will begin with talking about lunar laser ranging. Lunar laser ranging is a really legacy of the Apollo program. In Apollo 11, deployment of lunar Korneguppe arrays in 1969, and Buzz Aldrin carrying on the left the panel of Korneguppe reflectors, which were deployed on the lunar surface. And so in Apollo 11 initiated shift from analyzing lunar position angles to ranges. The present day accuracy is roughly about 5 millimeters, limited by Earth atmosphere. You can imagine that we measure distances between Earth and the Moon to the very small number, less than a centimeter, which is unique. Then you see a lunar Apollo 11 lander, Apollo 14 Korneguppe reflectors, the panels between are similar between Apollo 11 and Apollo 14, are similar Korneguppe panels. Apollo 15 is a little bit larger. You see sets of Korneguppe reflectors on Apollo 15 panel. It's about 300 reflectors. They're about 3.8 centimeters. And the benefit of those Korneguppe reflectors is that when you shine a laser light into them, the light is being triply reflected from the edges of the Korneguppe. It comes back exactly in the direction it came from. So this is very useful for measuring distances, propagation distances between observatories on the Moon, on the Earth, and the Korneguppe reflectors on the Moon. Within the course of Apollo 11, Apollo 14, Apollo 15 missions, and also Luna 17 and Luna 21 Russian missions that were deploying two lunar rovers called Lunokhods. And Lunokhods carried French-built panels of Korneguppe reflectors. Over the years, the precision with which we ranged the Moon essentially changed from roughly 20 centimeters to now less than a centimeter. And RMS residuals are at the level of roughly 15 millimeters. And we need to move down to 1 millimeter because this precision opens a very significant area to test fundamental physics.
Laser ranging is, Terry Shiv pointed out, very accurate.
So there are multiple stations on Earth that are involved in lunar laser ranging. This is truly international community. We began the lunar laser ranging with using McDonald lunar laser ranging operation. Then French-built observatory Côte d'Azur joined the list of stations, and actually it's a very productive station. Recently moved from working on green laser, now working in infrared 1064, and essentially you see that Observatory Côte d'Azur provided a lot of normal points in infrared band. So there are multiple other stations throughout the globe, several stations in Europe and in Africa. And so many more stations are being built. This is very exciting development now because we have multiple activities, ongoing activities on the Moon and actually on the ground. The top right chart, you see statistics of ranging different Korneguppe reflectors. As I mentioned, there are five Korneguppe panels. And until now, to 2019, Apollo 15 was the most ranged reflector, and it has roughly 67% of all the normal points. But after introducing infrared capability Observatory Côte d'Azur in 2019, there's pretty much even coverage of several reflectors. And so going forward, we'll expect to have pretty much similar coverage of those reflectors and the new ones that will be deployed on the Moon. Nevertheless, there are some selection effects. There's very few normal points acquired during new Moon and during full Moon. So in the transition, you have many more points, but really the challenge is actually get the data point from new Moon and full Moon, because that actually will enable us to improve the tests of general relativity and studying lunar interior.
For well over a century, scientists have been putting Einstein's theory of relativity to the test. Is his theory the final say, or could it, at some level of accuracy, prove to be incorrect?
This data is used to make major advances in the tests of general relativity. One of the cornerstone principles in general relativity is the equivalence principle. Equivalence principle states that gravity is really agnostic towards the composition of the body. So when gravity couples to the any object, it should be immune with respect to body's composition. And so realistically, what we are doing, we are dropping the Earth and the Moon in the gravitational field of the Sun. And so if the equivalence principle is not violated, the orbit of the Moon around Earth should be very well predicted. But if the equivalence principle is violated, we do expect polarization in lunar orbit. And so it will, the size of this polarization will be roughly 13 meters. And so the two, or the orbits of the two bodies, the Earth and the Moon, will deviate by 13 meters. And as I mentioned, so we measure this, this orbit of the Moon with a precision of roughly 1.4 centimeters. And so we have not seen this effect. And so that enables us to test general relativity to very high precision, and especially the violation of equivalence principle recently was tested at the level of roughly 2.4 × 10⁻¹⁴, which is the difference in accelerations of Earth and the Moon falling in the gravitational field of the Sun. So this is very good precision, because compared to the spacecraft tests of weak equivalence principle, which were recently conducted by the French-built microscope mission, we are reaching a similar precision in terms of uncertainty. So the microscope precision is roughly twice less than the lunar laser ranging, opening a very significant exploration area for us in the near future, because we definitely can move into this region and actually improve the precision by quite a few orders of magnitude. Strong equivalence principle, which is actually includes now not only the body composition, but actually the contribution of gravitational energy into the strong into the equivalence principle, was tested by the lunar laser ranging data to roughly 3.4 × 10⁻⁴, which is extremely good precision compared to the previous data. Several parameters, relativistic parameters, were tested independently, like parameter beta, which measures non-linearity of gravitational superposition. And so this is very interesting parameter, because we are really testing the regimes at which gravity may fail, and or the general theory of relativity may fail, because we are posed with very significant challenges from cosmology. For example, the presence of dark energy and dark matter in the universe and in the galaxies, spiral galaxies, alludes to the possibility of the breakdown in general relativity. So lunar laser ranging can test those theories that actually were predicted to explain those the puzzles in astrophysics and cosmology to very high precision. And so one of the recent tests of possibility that gravitational constant is not a constant, but really varying with time. So the G dot over G was measured to roughly precision of 10⁻¹⁴, just shy of that 10⁻¹⁴. And realistically, that implies that the gravitational constant evolved less than a 0.1% during the entire history of universe, which is a very strong conclusion and actually helps to improve our understanding of cosmology on various scales. So lunar laser ranging is extremely relevant experiment and should be continued, because now we are benefiting not only from the instruments, but also from the long duration of the data span that covers from 1970 all the to the present and going in the future.
To further test relativity, very precise measures will be required. Slava Tyryshev has ideas on how to do this.
So improving tests of improving the precision in with which we can take normal points of lunar laser ranging actually contributes quite significantly to our tests of to our ability to test general relativity. In this case, even a millimeter precision, which we are very close to, will enable us to improve the tests of weak equivalence principle, strong equivalence principle, and test the variability in the gravitational constant. But we are aiming now at 0.1 millimeter, which is possible with the technologies that are already being deployed on the Moon or being developed. So with this, we will be definitely working in a very new regime. And so within the next 5 to 10 years, we should be able to approach very impressive limits with which we can test possible deviations from general relativity and test theories for cosmology and astrophysics that were proposed to explain dark matter, dark energy, those phenomena that actually are quite puzzling. But not only that, lunar laser engine is extremely relevant to conducting lunar science. With lunar laser engine, we can precisely position the positions of the coronal cube reflectors on the moon. And by doing that, we are studying lunar interior. So we can identify positions of the moon, of those retroreflectors to less than a centimeter level. And so low degree gravity field is being distinguished from mantle and the core. But the most exciting part is that we are now sensing the core, the lunar core. As you know, there is a liquid core inside the moon, which is roughly 420 kilometers. And so there is a solid core inside of roughly 60 kilometers in diameter. So lunar laser engine indicates the composition of the moon and actually will enable us to talk more, to get more data as on the lunar interior and study the composition of the moon and the history of the moon, which is extremely relevant to our studies of other celestial bodies, such as Phobos, Deimos, as if we plan to go to Mars. So this type of research is extremely relevant. But besides that, lunar laser engine is very important to establishing lunar reference frame. It provides three-dimensional orbit orientation of the moon and the inertial frame defined by international coordinate reference frame. It allows to establish positions and on the moon and navigating spacecraft around the moon, which is extremely important for the upcoming activities with respect to Artemis program, and essentially will help to position a lunar lander on the surface to very high precision. And so lunar laser engine is used to determine orbit orientation of the moon as a function of time, which is extremely important. And so anticipating an ongoing developments, we look for new coronal cube retroreflector instruments to be deployed on the moon within the CLIPS program. And so not only the passive instruments will be deployed, but also active optical transceivers will be deployed on the moon, which is extremely exciting. And also there are some facilities that are being built on the moon, which on the Earth, which will help us to improve tests of general relativity and to conduct studies of the lunar interior.
Lasers are shone on the Apollo retroreflectors from astronomical observatories on Earth. The collecting telescopes are fitted with very sensitive photon detectors.
One of the facilities that I'd like to highlight is the facility on the Table Mountain Observatory in California. We are using here a 1 kilowatt laser, which is roughly 200 times more more powerful than the laser that are used on other facilities. With this type of instrument, we are able to conduct very exciting research. So with the 2 kilowatt average power, we are able to reach precision of roughly 30 micron, which is differential range precision, and focusing on lunar interior. With this type of facility, we can conduct studies of the moon, tests of general relativity to very high precision, much better than currently possible. So by switching between different coronal cubes on the moon, we initiate a very new observable, which is difference laser engine, which is limited only by Earth atmosphere to roughly 30 microns. And so now our emphasis will be on the lunar interior in addition to general relativity. So we are getting very significant flux from the coronal cube arrays already on the moon. We're getting roughly 10 to the fourth photons per second. This is flux, which is quite different compared to single photon detection that is done by other stations on Earth.
Research scientist Tereshev thinks it is feasible to deliver power to the moon via laser.
So with the lunar laser engine that established on the Table Mountain, we are now talking about actually transmitting power to the moon. So we can deliver up to 5 kilowatt power on the moon by using high power lasers, arraying them in small arrays on Earth. So essentially we are thinking about putting in a small array, which is roughly 50 to 100 small ground-based telescopes, each of them like 30 centimeter in diameter. With this type of array arrayed in 10 by 10 telescopes, we can deliver up to 5 kilowatt power, continuous power on the moon, which is quite exciting because now we can deliver power and allow for multiple instruments to sustain lunar nights before any nuclear power will be deployed on the moon. But lunar laser engine and essentially high power opportunities allow us to really deploy very interesting opportunities for the moon to allow for survival of instruments on the moon. So once power on the moon is available, we can conduct multiple other experiments, such as using radio beacons on lunar landers. We can conduct same beam interferometry and VLBI delta door experiments, as those were done by MIT in 1970s and JPL by the same time, looking at the radio beacons from ALSEP packages on the moon, essentially, and observing them on the background of extragalactic quasars. So this is extremely powerful because this technique will allow us to reach similar precision to lunar laser engine at roughly few millimeters precision. This is a new technique that is emerging. And so also lunar radio ranging, once we have beacons on the moon that are capable, sort of the landers on the moon with very precise transponders, will allow us to conduct ranging to those landers on the moon. And the lunar radio ranging can be done with a few millimeters precision. And essentially similar science compared to that of lunar laser engine will be able to be studied. And so once we do that, essentially lunar laser engine and lunar radio engine are complementary, because lunar radio engine, you can range through lunar full moon and new moon. Essentially, that will allow us to have a continuous coverage of lunar assets. So in addition to that, same beam interferometry and inverse VLBI methods will be extremely powerful, because now we have radio sources with continuous power, and we should be able to reach similar millimetric precisions. And all of this will be helpful to study the moon, to establish reference frame for navigation and dark navigation in cislunar activities. Next opportunity will be optical transceivers, which will allow us to reach even higher precision range in the moon. Optical transceivers will be deployed for communication and navigation purposes. And so the precision that we're able to reach with optical transceivers are in the submillimeter and in the micron level. So this is quite unique. That will be very helpful for navigation and fundamental physics.
In summary, Slava Tereshev has this to say.
So what is to expect in the near future? The anticipated developments. We have the Kornacup arrays being deployed on the moon as NGLRs, with the dark Curie being the PI, so where is a solid single Kornacup is being deployed. MIST and PNT beacons, position navigation timing beacons, will be deployed on the moon to enable early development of the radio techniques. Emerging opportunities, we have laser optical transceivers on the moon. There may be clocks on the various constellations. There will be high precision laser range and navigation from TMO, and also power delivery to the ground-based arrays to the arrays on the moon. That will be quite an important development. Once the power, dust, communication, thermal issues are addressed, I guess then the astrophysics and planetary physics and heliophysics will have a renaissance from the moon, because we can do a lot of interesting studies in terms of planetary sciences, search for near-Earth asteroids, monitoring the entire environment around Earth, study heliophysics, space weather network on the moon. And the most interesting, I think, it's a far sight when we will deal with cosmology and astrophysics, studying evolution of the universe in 21 centimeters, because 21 centimeter radio essentially is being quite polluted on the ground. But on the far side of the moon, we can do a very exciting science, really touching the beginning of the universe after Big Bang. So this is exciting science, and we are looking for emerging opportunities and to conduct science from the lunar surface.
The dangers of flammable materials in spacecraft was brought to public attention in January of 1967. That's when fire killed three astronauts rehearsing for the Apollo 1 mission. This tragedy still haunts the space industry. Tests of flames have been conducted in zero gravity conditions on the International Space Station. But what of lunar gravity, where the field strength is 1.6 newtons per kilogram? That's 1/6 of the 9.6 experienced here on Earth. Gary Ruff is project manager of the Spacecraft Fire Safety Demonstration Unit at the Glenn Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio. In August of 2021, he set out a plan to answer the question, how do flames spread in lunar gravity?
What I'm going to be talking about in this presentation is really just some of the things that we know about, you know, flame spread, material flammability in lunar gravity. And one of the things is that for partial gravity, not meaning microgravity there, but for partial gravity levels other than Earth, you know, we've received a limited amount of study, and it's primarily because of what we have available for us to conduct these experiments. So I want to discuss a little bit what we've learned so far and how we're planning to explore or prepare for exploration missions to the Moon and Mars. So objectives are really to describe how do we expect flames and flame spread to be different in lunar gravity than in normal gravity, and what methods can we use to investigate lunar G flammability. Obviously, the first thing, as others have said, is that, you know, we've got 1/6 gravity, and so you're going to be affecting buoyancy driving force that comes from a temperature gradient in a flame. And so that buoyant flow velocity will affect other flame parameters. And so what I wanted to do here with just some equations, I want to make some statements about how we would expect flames to be different. So if you're looking at the buoyant velocity and, you know, apply some approximations, and assuming for right now that the flame temperature is not affected by gravity changes, you can use conservation equations and get this expression for the buoyant velocity. And when you put in just that gravity difference of 0.16 g, you get that the lunar velocity, lunar buoyant velocity, would be on the order of 0.4 buoyant velocity on the Earth. Now, that contributes to other differences in the flame, and start looking at things like a flame standoff distance that shows the standoff distance definition just by how far the flame is from a fabric sample. This is a concurrent flame, and that distance is proportional to the boundary layer thickness. And if you continue to work all that through, you find that it depends upon the buoyancy and pressure. And you can do the same thing with heat flux from the solid flame to a solid and work that through. And here, then that temperature difference comes into play. The concurrent flame spread rate, you know, kind of the same way. And the convective heat transfer coefficient. You know, modeling has shown that these pictures, that rather than collecting on the ceiling, you really have to raise the entire cabin up to the alarm level. But then when you've got partial gravity, yeah, now you've got buoyancy, so the smoke would want to go towards the surface, but there's also, where do you put the air intake so that maybe you can remove dust particles? So depending upon the rate of smoke generation and the competition between buoyancy and ECLIS rate, you could be defeating your fire detection purpose. Obviously, don't have a whole lot of data at partial gravity because of the lack of test platforms. You know, it indicates that theory and experimental results, oxygen flammability limits in lunar G are lower than those in 1G, and the configurations that will not support a flame in low gravity could support a flame in lunar gravity. The percent oxygens for planned atmospheres exacerbates all of these issues by enhancing flammability, and additional work is needed. Lunar gravity can change the fire detection strategy. And of course, one thing I didn't really touch on much, but obviously if you turning off the ECLIS flow to extinguish a fire in lunar G isn't effective because you still have buoyancy. So you're still going to have some effect of drawing oxygen into the flame. And so that's going to be you're going to have to look at that in fire suppression. And we are working now to quantify the magnitude of the delta percent oxygen and a combination, using a combination of modeling, low gravity aircraft, drop tower centrifuge, rotating capsule to start to answer some of these questions.
Flames and lunar gravity is just one of many areas where there are gaps in lunar research. Francis Chiaramonte is program scientist for physical sciences in the Biological and Physical Sciences Division at NASA headquarters. In August of 2021, she advocated some transformative research that could be done if we fill some priority knowledge gaps.
In this division and in this directorate, there's a focus on something called transformative research. We have two major areas that we're going to pursue, but I thought I'd just introduce that topic a little bit here and maybe help with people to understand what that might mean. So, very simply put, it's the research that we're looking to do is challenging current understanding, all right, and providing pathways to new frontiers. So I know in general people intrinsically say, well, research, you know, often does challenge current understanding. That's probably why we're doing it. I think the focus might be that look for ways to do bigger impact. ways that can be most effective, just to give you that broad drop. Okay. And then, so as mentioned before, but I like to kind of put a spin on it here, the major way to look at the moon, and so such a wonderful, unique opportunity coming up, is two ways. One, NASA and its international partners and industry are going back to the moon, as I imagine all of you know. And so part of the goals of the workshop is for all of us to help identify challenges and knowledge gaps and help in that way and participate in trying to close some of those gaps and enable us to go to the moon, right? So, but the trick is not so much in the technology. There are sister groups at NASA that will handle developing machinery and excavating lunar regolith and building habitats and roads and landing pads. So that's not us. We're the group behind that is looking at if there are research areas and opportunities on the moon to help enable that exploration, missing understanding about the material properties of some new lunar binder or cement, perhaps, that needs to be developed. What is the optimal composition? And how did we arrive at that? And how does microgravity play a role? And any of the other, for that matter, any of the other variables play a role, such as temperature or radiation. That's how we can be productive here, is simply to look at it from a research, of sort of an applied research perspective on helping to fill the gaps behind the technology that needs to be developed. The other way to look at the moon is it's just like another laboratory. So instead of having a lab at your university or institution, now all of a sudden, this satellite itself is in a laboratory, and it's yours to dream with and develop ideas, all right? And those ideas can be due to its unique microgravity environment, the vacuum, right? The temperature, huge temperature swings, the radiation, you know, as it goes around the Earth and the whole system goes around the sun, and you're getting that radiation, and there's no atmosphere, it's uniquely different radiation than what we experience here on Earth. And the fact that we have a magnetic field, it's just a new testbed or a new platform for just pure science, right? Not about exploration, not about putting people on it. It's a laboratory, and it's yours.